This is a recording of the Emerging Adulthood Mini-Conference held on Saturday, January 20th, 2018 at the Menno Simons Center in Vancouver, British Columbia. Introductory remarks are by Thomas Bergen, and the talk is by Gil Duick. Members of the audience also ask questions throughout the talk. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the Pacific Center for Discipleship Association. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the Society's board. For more information, please visit our website at pcda.bc.ca.
How do I grow in Christ? So that's, I think, in a sense, what we're going to try to talk about. How do we do that ourselves? How do we help others to do that? How do we grow in Christ? And growth is one of those words, I think, that implies a kind of metaphorical world of greenery, of life. And I think right now we live in a world that's in a different metaphorical mind space, where it's more about performance and spectacle and circus and balancing life work, juggling demands, balls dropping, going through hoops to get the next thing in life. So it's more like a circus world as opposed to the world that God has made, in which is greenery and life, and we're a part of that and invited into that to grow as well. So how do we grow in Christ? That's, I guess, the question I want us to think about for our devotion today. And my wife, she would love to be here, but she is currently at the Richmond Hospital working in obstetrics and pediatrics. But she brought home this chart for me, and I saw it. Oh, that's very interesting. It's about growth for babies. Mm-hmm. And how doctors chart it out very specifically about what needs to happen at certain stages of development. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I can kind of check myself to see, if theoretically about a baby, I could check myself to see, am I at the right developmental milestone? So at 2 months, you're supposed to have a motor skill where you can lift your head. You're supposed to have a social skill of reciprocating a smile. You're supposed to have a cognitive skill of recognizing your parents. Then when you get to 6 months, you're supposed to be able to sit. You're supposed to reach for objects. You're supposed to be able to babble and to feed. And then 12 months, you can stand. You can say a word. One word, it says. Usually it's mom or dad. And you can point to desired objects. So you see there's a kind of development that happens. And it's very chartable, at least until you get to 60 months. And then it just stops. And I guess our question today is, if we could continue this, right, what would we say is the milestone at this age or that age? Now, this kind of gives the impression of living in a scientific world of objective realities and so forth. Something maybe called the dawning of consciousness, human culture, it kind of gets in the way and things get more complicated. Right? We have all sorts of different cultural definitions of adulthood and maturity. But at the same time, those have very powerful impact on us. I think our cultural definitions of adulthood and growth have a very powerful influence on us. But as Christians, what is our, developmental grid or standard? And I think it's Christ. I think it's Christ-likeness. And this is the message we hear in Ephesians 4 about growth in Christ. So I'm going to read that passage now. Paul writes, "He himself, that is Christ, gave the apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers to equip his people for works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up, until we all reach unity in the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ." So that's the vision. And then it says, "As a result, we will no longer be infants tossed to and fro by the every wind and wave of teaching, and drawn away by the cunning craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. Instead, we'll be able to speak the truth in love. We'll grow up into Him that is Christ, who is the head, From him the whole body is joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love. So this capacity to love, this capacity to speak the truth, this is what it means to be like Christ. And then, of course, in the rest of Ephesians 4, he goes on even more explicitly. He talks about our emotional life, how we deal with our anger, how our speech life, how we speak, our interrelationships, and so on and so forth. So there's a vision there, basically, of that Paul is trying to communicate to his culture about what his growth looks like. And we, too, as Christians now, we need to find a vision as well. But what does it mean for us to grow, and how do we do it? So let me start by praying, and then we're going to invite Gil up. So Father, we thank you that you are the God who calls us to growth. And we thank you, Lord, that you meet us at all those crossroads in our lives where we're tempted to shirk back. And that you are the one who gives grace and strength for every challenge. Lord, we pray that you would help us in our morning time together today to spur each other on to seek you and find you and help others also to seek you and find you. And we thank you also, Lord, for people like Gil and Suzanne who devoted their life to this ministry. And Lord, we pray that you'd open our ears and our hearts to hear from them. Amen. Amen. All right, Gil. Please.
Good morning. It's good to be here and see. Well, I can only confess the two familiar faces, which is Andrew in the back and Thomas in the front, but I met a few of you already. It's good to be at the Mount Simon Center and wait here, so I'll get out of the way. I'm never going to be able to stand. It's going to be the least offensive. Can I bring this?
Yeah.
All right. So thanks, Thomas, for these words to begin, this important text from Ephesians. I think you could think about whatever's going to follow as sort of an extended meditation on Ephesians, the text that you just read, as a contemplation of maturity, a contemplation of what it means to progress in the Christian faith. So really, this is all footnote to what you've already read for us here. Especially, I think, as we hear again, this simultaneous sense of unity in the faith and maturity in Christ. This is one of the giant questions I think we face in a secular context, where that unity in the faith seems like a narrowing and a smaller thing than maturity. So that's one of the things we might come back to later on. Just to introduce myself a little bit, I'm brand new to BC. I am a child of the prairies. I grew up in southern Alberta on a farm, so I have a lot of meat and potatoes in my system. And that's a metaphor. You can fill in the blanks however you want. I have spent a good chunk of my life jumping through a variety of institutional hoops that the church set for me. So whether that was youth group or camp as a kid, or eventually Bible college in Saskatchewan, to seminary, and to a whole bunch of different things in between. So in some ways I'm a walking cliche in that sense of all these different kind of institutional pathways for maturity, I guess you could put it that way. I spent some time as a student in Bethany College in Saskatchewan, which has since closed in 2015. I met my wife in the aftermath of that. We spent some time in California at seminary. Moved back to Calgary for a little while, spent about 14 years back at Bethany on staff there, and then a year with MCC, and then moved out here to Abbotsford July of this past year to take up a position at Columbia Bible College. So that's sort of the trajectory of my life. Along the way, beginning in 2008, I began to work on a PhD through, what's it called now? It was at the time called the International Baptist Theological Seminary. It's changed since then. And it started off affiliated with the University of Wales, located in Prague in the Czech Republic, but moved midstream to Amsterdam and affiliated with a different university, which is where I finally, so it was an 8-year journey. And that dissertation was essentially a meditation on adulthood and what it means to grow up. People say that most dissertations are at least partly autobiographical. That's certainly the case in my experience, where as I look back on it now, I was seeking to make my own experience theologically intelligible. I think is the way I would put it. So that's a bit of what we're gonna find here this morning. I have been married to Shelley for 18 years. We have three daughters. We are 14, 12, and 10. So this has become a very lively question as I contemplate my own daughter's growth, and as I see now a 14-year-old adjusting to a new city and anticipating what's next and trying to figure out what does all this theory look like in the context of a particular life in a particular place, and a very personal interest now, obviously, in what this transition looks like. So that's a bit about who I am. I'd love to meet a few of you as we go on this morning and hear a bit about how any of this resonates with your experience. So, emerging adulthood is the theme. I'll try to walk through this a little bit, but I do want to pause along the way and ask for any input. So I hope it's going to be a bit of a conversational approach this morning, and we'll see how far we get. We'll see if this works too. So an image has guided me throughout, and it's good where Thomas started this morning. This is an imperfect image in many ways, but it's an image that I have returned to often as I have contemplated this particular topic. You can imagine these two tracks sort of extending into an indefinite horizon. On the left, you could imagine something like the chart that Thomas began with this morning, with certain incremental stages in our development as people. So there are certain things we would expect cognitively, socially, emotionally, as we move down that track. Inconveniently, of course, we stopped at, what was it, 2 years we stopped in this chart?
Six.
Okay. So, but we know that there's good maps that have been created about what that process looks like as we get to adolescence and into adulthood. It starts to become a bit fuzzier, and we move a little bit more from description into prescription, and we're not totally sure what basis we're doing that on. But generally, we can sketch out what a normal, healthy process of human development might look like. If you think about the right-hand side, you might envision that as trying to get at what it means to develop as disciples of Jesus Christ. And so we have a sense that these two things kind of belong together, and in that sense, the image breaks down pretty quickly, because those two tracks aren't, of course, separate in our actual experience of life. They're very much one track that we move down as unified individuals, but we also, I think, have a sense that it's possible to progress on one track and maybe stall on the other. That it's possible to, especially as we think about the transition to adulthood, we see, I think, good statistical evidence that a lot of people are continuing down the one track and stopping on the other, or at least settling for, especially I would say in my corner of the church, where there's perhaps a bit of a conversionist impulse when we talk about faith, that the big deal is getting over a certain hurdle in the early stage of life. That's the big decision. It can be easy to stay there. And as we progress into adulthood, whether that's university or work or whatever else, it can be easy to look back and say, that thing that I got when I was 5, 6, 7 in the church, that's not really changed much. And it doesn't really, it's harder to get across those two tracks now at 25 than it was at 5 or 6. So what we're asking is, how do these two things go together? And in many ways, what I've studied has been a mapping exercise. How do we map these progressions? And are they happening in healthy ways? And can we talk about that in language that makes some kind of sense? So, a quick word on what it means to talk about generations. So we live in a time when there is a lot of interest, I would say, if I can figure out how to do this, in analyzing generations and saying, well, this is what boomers are like, or behind that, the great generation, or the builders, as they're sometimes called, or this is what Gen X looks like. Actually, nobody talks about that. I'm part of Generation X, the forgotten generation in between the boomers and what are known as the millennials. Now there's even a new term I just learned that's called iGen, which is the generation that was roughly born out of the millennium, that has never known a world without the internet. So this is there is an interest, there's an appetite, certainly, culturally, for talking about this. We're talking about generations and making comparisons and saying, well, this is what's unique about this one, and these are the weird proclivities of this one, and this is how we're changing. And all of that, I would say, is interesting. It sells books. It makes for good TV, for the most part. But there's limitations. And I'm not totally, well, I'll test this and stick with you and see what you think. I think these are worth discussing primarily because they help us to get a changing culture. People are, in many ways, people. I think when we look at how one group of people is coming of age, let's say in 2017 or 18, and compare that with what it looked like to come of age in the 50s or the 80s or whatever else, there's nothing that's essentially changed about people, but the environment certainly has. And the cultural mood that that takes place within has certainly changed. So my proposal, and it's only a proposal, is that when we do something like what we're going to do today, and we say, what's going on with the transition to adulthood among young people today, I would like to do that in a way that A, recognizes that young people are not so different from young people in the past, but that the world is changing in some important ways, and that's worth paying attention to. So we can use it as sort of as a cultural diagnostic. It can help us to understand our surroundings in a bit of a unique way. I want to begin with a quote from an American poet named Christian Wiman. Have you heard of Christian Wiman here? He wrote a book called My Bread Abyss, which is a really worthwhile, penetrating book. But he says this, it's caught me off guard whenever I've seen it. In the tenderest spots of human experience, he says, nothing is more offensive than an intellectualized understanding. So that's just a way of saying everything that's going to fall is going to be really offensive today, because we're going to try to understand something that's quite profound, I would say even holy, which is how people grow and how people change. And I speak as a researcher and as a teacher, but certainly also as a parent. And there is something that is deeply profound about watching a life grow. And there's some part of us, I think, that should recoil and say, what? You're going to try and systematize that? You're going to try to make some kind of formula that's going to explain all that? That's kind of gross, actually. You shouldn't do that. So we're going to try, and we're going to try and do it in a minimally offensive way. But recognize at the beginning that there's a mystery and there's a holiness, too. It's a human life under God. We could bear the image of God that I think will always resist a completely formulaic understanding. Something far less profound, but equally interesting. I'm sure some of you have seen the movie Interstellar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So someone help me out with the basic plot line. There's an astronaut. Who's seen it recently? Anybody here?
Astronaut, essentially, Earth is dying, the crops are dying, they're looking for a new place to colonize, and so they find a few astronauts that go, it's a last-ditch effort.
Yeah. And so the lead character is played by Matthew McConaughey. I forget his name. Anyways, he's talking to his daughter. He's about to embark on this mission to find another place for humanity to live, and he's contemplating what it means to say goodbye in a context where he might never see her again, which of course is a very poignant point in the film. And he says something that's caught me off guard then and now. He says this: once you're a parent, you're the ghost of your children's future. His name's Cooper, I just realized. Okay. What's your parent? You're the ghost of your children's future. Well, that's a pretty penetrating insight, actually. When I think about, okay, when my daughter is 35, 40 years old, she's going to have a ghost. She's going to have voices that are echoing in her mind. And those are maybe even going to be mine, which is a pretty terrifying insight, actually. Because it means that all my sins and all my kind of idiosyncrasies and the mistakes that I make day by day in terms of how I interact with her, that is actually going to resonate. It's going to be there in the future. Even if I'm not, this is the insight that Cooper comes to. I might not be there, but I'm still going to be there. I might be wherever, colonizing some other planet, but you'll still hear me. And I think this is an important insight when it comes to how we in the church think about faith development. I think there's lots of ghosts that we have in our head as we talk about what it means to grow up into the image of Christ. I think there's lots of, I see it all the time in myself, I see it in others. There are reactions that we are living out day by day to ghosts from the past, from our parents in the faith, let's say. That when we speak and when we act and when we think about what it means to grow up into Christ, that we have certain voices in our heads. Some of those are healthy, some of those are not. And so when we contemplate our debt to the future, well, I think it's worth paying attention to what kind of ghosts are we creating today that the next generation will be responding to. So that's a question that occupies me a bit. All that to say, we're talking about something hard to get a handle on, but deeply important, I would say, when it comes to this question: what does adulthood mean? What does it mean in life? What does it mean in faith? Okay. So what are we talking about when we use this word adulthood? It's a slippery word. It's a confusing word. It's a word that we use to point towards some kind of an arrival. Okay? Some kind of destination, some kind of resolution. So adolescence and childhood are this unstable time where we're anticipating a future resolution. Adulthood sort of is the word that we use to capture that. But we really struggle sometimes to figure out what we mean by it. And I'm saying, well, let's not experiment. Let's just ask the question. Would we have a great at-hand definition for how we would define a term as slippery as adulthood?
Does it mean I can't play video games anymore?
Well, maybe. So there's a good example. There's an instinctive sense in which we're like, well, probably not. I don't really know why I would say that. I don't know if you do, Kevin, but there's no judgment here necessarily. But it's a great little example. Because we all have this nervous laughter, well, probably, maybe.
Not too much.
Yeah, not hours and hours.
It used to be defined by when you could get married.
Okay, so marriage used to be an indicator. But I think we would, I don't know, anybody here that's under 30, there's a few of you, I think. How does that definition sound? Adulthood equals marriage.
That's just scary. I'll not raise it up.
Say it again.
That's a little bit scary to say that already.
Can I just add that I would think that adulthood means that you're on your own and you're responsible for your own life, responsible for your own support.
Okay. Financial support.
Financial support. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. Which is a risky thing to talk about in a place like Vancouver.
And marriage may be part of that, I don't know. Along the way.
How old do you have to be self-sufficient financially in Vancouver?
It's difficult.
I know a little bit about the trauma of what it feels like in Abbotsford, but that's nothing you can read to hear. So, yeah, financial self-sufficiency is
part of it. It's tough nowadays.
It's tough, yeah. So we have marriage, we have sort of some kind of financial... Yeah.
I think it's unique to talk financially, especially to college students.
Yeah.
So, like, living here, I'm technically not connected to my parents anymore. Yeah. And financially, I'm not formally either in any way. But yet, when I go home for Christmas, does that mean I'm relying on them that now I'm not an adult when I go home for 2 or 3 weeks, right? Like, I think that's the interesting discussion of, like, even independence. Because independence, I think we never will actually fully be removed. Well, I shouldn't say never. It depends on your family context. But in a family that is relational with one another, I don't think you'll ever actually be removed from some sort of dependent relation of one to another. So,
nor is that desirable.
No.
To be removed.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, just throw in again that unity in the faith is one of the signs of maturity. So this maybe this idealizing of independence could be possibly problematic.
There's certainly an individualistic streak in that that we can certainly challenge from a biblical perspective, I would say. Is that what you're getting at,
kind of?
Yeah.
Well, I actually kind of look at it as not just being careful, like youth would be cared for, and caring, but adult would be at the point to where you can care for others. Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily regard it as independence.
But maybe a shift in focus from I'm the one receiving care to I'm now responsible for others?
To that point.
Yeah.
That flips.
Really good. So I think you could say, okay, so we're already asking the question, well, what is it? Second of all, the question is, how do you know when you've arrived? Well, this is typically when someone says, well, you never do, right? But do we? If adulthood is a destination, if it represents some kind of resolution to the question of human development, what does arrival look like? So we have some indicators that there used to be sort of a sense that this was associated with roles, like becoming a parent, like maybe acquiring a career, becoming, well, a spouse in the first case, maybe. Social roles is maybe one indicator. But those roles, statistically speaking, at least, are all being put off significantly compared to when they used to be. I think the average, let's say the average age for a woman to have her first child, children, the Canadian census data is now over 30. Just a significant shift from two generations ago. Almost an 8 or 9 year shift. The marriage is put off, if it's even undertaken at all. One earlier definition I saw of adulthood, which creates a generational kind of shift, has been, well, you get a mortgage. Well, that's maybe when you're 100 here. I'm not sure. So those kinds of typical shifts that maybe represent sort of a post-war economic boom kind of era. Get married, have a kid, get a mortgage, white picket fence, work at the factory until you're 60, then you retire. That pathway is less and less common, less and less possible even. So those markers maybe don't resonate anymore, but if those markers don't indicate arrival, what does?
Is there an internal sense of self that changes?
I'll say some more, I'm curious about that one. An internal sense of what?
Of self, you know, when I think back to my childhood, I love this word progress to maturity. I think that is, it's like, why do we have to measure it? But we do it, we have a growing sense of ourself as being something different than adolescence. I hate the question, where did you grow up? Because it's I have no idea. I have no idea where I grew up. Like, I am growing up. And I think that's what the Ephesians passage talks about. We are growing up. So I love this word progress, because I think we're all included. Do we ever arrive? I don't know. I guess
it's a great question, actually. Is it an open-ended process?
I think there's value in having a rite of passage of some sort. And culturally, this happens in different ways in different cultures. But I think there's a role for us here in Vancouver about speaking words of blessing and helping someone to realize, oh, I am allowed, or I am given permission, or I'm given respect of, you know, something has shifted.
Yeah, that is a marker.
We have a role of, you know, letting young people wear the long trousers. You know what I'm saying? Like, to say, we want to include you in the decision making. We value you. And I think there's something.
Yeah, part of my research into the process of coming to age involved a quick dip into cross-cultural kinds of patterns of how cultures recognize adulthood. In one tribe that got some publicity through a paper that was published, well, the answer to that question was, you're an adult when you get to eat meat. Because the children would never get meat. And when you finally arrive, well, then you come to the table, you get to eat meat, and then you know that I've crossed the threshold here. I'm now part of the tribe, so it's a socially recognized. I don't decide when I'm an adult. Someone else decides for me, which is a radical difference than what you're describing, which is that I have a sense of myself. Very different. So is it a socially recognized thing? Do other people tell me when I'm an adult? Or do I tell myself? Or does it even matter, maybe, is the question that you're asking? Does it, we need to nail it down with any precision. So there is both a descriptive element to this term. It's a way of saying time passes. There's a difference between an adult and an adolescent and a child. Even adolescence, of course, is a bit of a constructed stage of development. It didn't exist even 150 years ago if you were a child. And then when you could go to work, you were an adult. That was kind of the two stages. Adolescence has its roots in sort of mandatory secondary education, which was a response to, we are horrified by our children working in these horrific factories in the Industrial Revolution. So we create primary education, which extends a period of life, which creates adolescence. Now you could say, well, now that you have to get 8 or 9 years of post-secondary to get a livable job, you're creating another stage, which is maybe what we could describe as emerging adulthood. So time passes, there's a difference. There's also a prescriptive element that's embedded in this term. You should grow up. So we giggle a bit when Kevin says, should someone my age be playing video games? We sort of say, what kind of grow up, Kevin? I can say because I don't know him very well. But I think we have these instinctive reactions when we sense it's going off course, when someone isn't where they should be. I think we see it acutely. I don't want to give into too many stereotypes. But lots of people are asking questions about whether young men today are growing up at an acceptable rate. We're not so worried about the women. They're in many ways outperforming the men, in almost every way, actually. But we said something's gone off when, I don't mean to pick on you guys. But I think we know when something, or we in speaking to it, something's not right here. If you're still living in your parents' basement, playing video games at age 35, we sort of know that that's maybe not how it should be. So grow up already. Yeah.
one of the things I see, certainly, again, maybe from my professional perspective, is entering an adulthood is when you go from being mentored to mentoring others, which you mentioned, Ken.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important sort of
What's crossed there in your assessment?
What has crossed?
Yeah, what's the key shift that's taking place there?
I think that the confidence of knowing that I have a certain body of experience and knowledge that I can now impart to you, and society kind of expects me to do that, and I'm sort of fulfilling that role that's expected of me. And I think, of course, people do that at completely different ages, you know. Kind of going from being a swimmer to being a lifeguard. Across a point where, hey, I know what I'm doing now. I can teach you. I just
want confidence, you know, in your experience. Yep. That's what that needs to. That has a requirement within it to pass on to somebody else. Yeah.
And a responsibility.
Absolutely. Which is a word that we don't use as much as we perhaps used to.
And like kind of on that thought, like what he said about caring for others, like I like the word caring, because like Donald Trump, he's the president, but does he care?
He's an adult. Yeah.
You know, kind of like responsibility.
It's a good point, because lots of people, what's among the many things that have taken people off guard with Trump has been this kind of self-orientation, this kind of narcissism it's about me. Am I getting enough attention? Am I getting enough? Are the ratings good? Like, do people approve of me? There's something about that feels childish in some ways.
Which is arrested development.
Well, this is the term, right?
Fire and fury, you know, he's arrested.
So behind this, these are the two questions that are going to actually help us to clarify what this term emerging adulthood might add. Is it changing? Is the transition to adulthood changing in any observable way in the first part of the 21st century? And what should it look like? Is it happening in healthy ways? Are there problems or possibilities within that transition? I'm obviously going to make the case that there is something changing. It's up to us to decide how significant that is or what we should do with that. But it seems like something is changing, and the term that I have landed on, not I myself, I've sort of been captured a bit by a theory that's emerged beginning in 1998, but has now developed an academic society. Thomas just told me there's a new Oxford Handbook?
Handbook.
I'll get the bibliography.
We'll give it out the end.
Okay, sure. So emerging adulthood is a term that only really starts being used in 1998. It's first used by a guy that you'll meet in a minute named Jeffrey Arnett in an article, and then later on, over the first 15 or so years of the 21st century, it really gained a lot of traction. People started saying, yeah, this is describing something, at least in the West, and we have to talk about it because the timetable's changing in some important ways that we've got to be aware of. But before we get to that, I want to just remind us, there's nothing truly new under the sun. This is from 1855, from a Davidson College professor, whose quote is that students are indulged, petted, and uncontrolled at home, with an undisciplined mind and an uncultivated heart, yet with exalted ideas of personal dignity and a scowling contempt for lawful authority. Immense as knowledge. Yeah. So somebody in 1855 was saying, what's wrong with these kids? What's going wrong with this next generation? Why are they so undisciplined, uncultivated? They think a lot of themselves. They think they're so important. There's this exalted idea of personal dignity and a scowling contempt for lawful authority. A couple of decades later,
I point out that he was referring to men only.
Men
only. There were no women in college.
1911, the wife of a Harvard professor, Diana West, says, "Today's youth are selfish, discourteous, lazy, self-indulgent, lacking respect for elders or for common decency. They are hedonistic, shallow, amusement-seeking creatures." It's quite a statement. So, for me, these kinds of things, they actually bring into focus what's been noted more recently by Eric Cooper, who's an admissions guy at the Maine University in the States, who says, "For as long as human hair has turned gray, elders have looked at their successors and frowned and said, there's something going wrong with that bunch." And I'm curious about why that might be. Why do you think that is? That there's this predisposition towards looking at the generation coming behind and saying, what's wrong? What's going on? it could be otherwise. And obviously, we can invest all kinds of hope and optimism into the next generation as well. This is not the only message, but there is a sort of cottage industry that's developed that says we should look at that generation and we should be at least partly worried. Something's going wrong with them. So that's something we can ponder as we maybe we see regret, maybe we see our own failings in the next generation. Maybe we wonder if they're going to make the same mistakes that we did. But we can talk about that one more as we go. So the actual theory of emerging adulthood was first articulated and expanded by this guy, Jeffrey Arnett. This book in 2000 is called Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s. I first came across this book as one of those, like, you might also be interested in links that come up after you buy a book on Amazon. There's this, since you bought this, you might like this kind of thing. And that's kind of where I first landed on this. It was a really, really weird kind of coincidence that it happened. I did what you should never do, which is I said, yeah, I'm in, I'll buy it, which is what they want you to do. And as I read it, I thought, this is actually, I read this when I was 29 years old, I believe. So at that point, at least, it was like an act of self-interpretation still, where I read this and thought, this is describing something about me. This is making my own 20s a little bit more intelligible to me. Then at that point, I was working with college students, so it was also, I still thought of myself naively as one of them, which is, I'm nowhere near that anymore, don't worry. It became useful in terms of understanding the world in which the students that I was interacting with were coming of age within. So this essentially launched the dissertation with this book, essentially. So basically, his argument's not that complicated. He's saying there's a new stage that's opened up in the West, primarily. He spent some time researching this in Europe and predominantly in North America. I think he's open to the possibility that this is also a function of wealth in some ways, that it's in wealthy cultures that you can afford to give people time to grow up in more subsistence-level economies. You don't really have the luxury. You've got to go to work. You've got to support the family, and so you've got to grow up, whatever that means, quicker. But he's saying in many Western contexts, this middle stage is new. That there is now this middle stage where people do not think of themselves as adolescents, but can't yet embrace the term adulthood. We don't feel, perhaps, like that's a word that applies to them, or at least can't fully embrace it. So I routinely, over my years working with college students, ask the question of small groups: Do you feel like you are one? You're legally able to vote. You're 18 years old or 20 or whatever. You're actually an adult, technically speaking. Are you one? No, was the answer immediately. Or the odd person would say yes. But the most, many guys often would say, well, no. Girls would say, well, maybe in some ways, but not in other ways. And then we would have fascinating conversations. I'll never forget one guy who told me, because I asked the question, well, how will you know when you get there? And one guy said, confidently, I will know that I'm an adult when I have to buy my first jug of milk. It's always been done for me by other people. So when I have to go to the store and buy my own milk, that's when I'll know that I finally arrived at an adulthood. So we're nowhere near the world of you get married and this is just milk. All right. Another significant researcher who's invested a lot of time in this kind of transition is a guy named Christian Smith, who's a sociologist at Notre Dame. And he says, this transition from the teenage years to fully achieved adulthood, we'll pause and just acknowledge that's an ambiguous term, has stretched out, it's longer, into this extended stage that is often amorphous, unstructured, convoluted. It lasts upwards of 12 or more years. 18, I own the paperwork here, says 18 to 25, that's where Arnett started. Now they're saying almost, it's 18 to 30, really, even beyond in some cases. During this time frame, emerging adults experience a freedom that is historically unparalleled. Enables them for many years to explore, experiment, discover, succeed, fail, move on, try again. So I think about my own coming of age experience and I compare that to my father's and my grandfather's. It's an amazing shift that's happened. My father was born in 1950. And when he was coming of age, I've asked him this question. What did you see on the horizon? What were the live options that were in front of you when you came out of high school? And he was like, well, it wasn't any. I just knew that if my dad was a farmer, so I had to farm, and I was the oldest son, and I had to do this. This was my duty, in a sense. I didn't have this agonized question, what am I going to do with my life? It wasn't at the front of my consciousness, like I suspect it has been for anybody here that's under 40, maybe even older than that. This omnipresent question that my 12-year-old daughter's already wrestling with, what am I going to do with my life? Part of me wants to say, just hold, just settle down here, but it's there. You can pick it up somewhere. So this is the new feature of modern kind of life, is that you actually have a lot more options. And you have to actually make this decision on your own. And it actually is an unparalleled freedom, which produces both costs and benefits. But it does create this decade or so of instability, of saying, well, I'm in university, but I'm going to do an internship, but I'm going to maybe change majors, and this four-year BA is going to become a six-year BA, and all of a sudden there's travel in the mix, and then I'm going to pay off some debt, and all of a sudden I'm 30, and still a lot of things up in the air, which is historically quite unique. So the key features that, this is back to Arnett now, he says when it comes to the key features, if you want to have one shorthand way of understanding what this term means, emerging adulthood, there's five key features that he points to. First of all, he says, this is an age where your big question is identity, which, if you follow Eric Erickson and the big developmental psychologists of the 20th century, was a task of adolescence. The question, who am I? Who am I that's maybe distinct from parents and from my community? Who am I? My sense of self, perhaps, to use the earlier term. That was largely seen as a question that belonged to adolescents. What most people are observing, anybody who works in a university context will probably confirm, but you can ask them that later, is that this is not finished by age 20, or even maybe by age 25, and maybe we could even ask the question, does it really terminate? So the big questions on people's minds is, who am I? So there's this sense that I got to piece it together. I have to discover that, first of all, then I got to add to that, and then I have to externalize that into the world. Key piece of the puzzle in this stage of life. So it's of course a very unstable period of life where you're not home anymore. The big shift is obviously leaving home, which produces a long period of instability and moving around, jumping from this to that. Financial insecurity is a big part of this for many. It is a very, and he's careful to use the word self-focused as opposed to selfish, because there is this stereotype of young people as these selfish amusement-seeking creatures that we saw in the earlier slide, that is a very narcissistic stage of life. And I don't want to dismiss that entirely, but I think it's overcooked if you say that your default setting is when people are just narcissists who are trying to figure out how to interact with society. There's definitely, I think, in a social media age, an emphasis on the self that's pretty strong, a maintenance of image, where we're constantly curating an identity online in front of others that is a bit weird historically. But there's a sense that my life and myself is a project that I got to figure out right now. Therefore, I got to spend some time looking at myself. I got to spend some time figuring out who I am. I got to try this or that. I got to see the world. I got to do things. Because I won't know the answer to the question, who am I, until I do that. So there's a different self-focus during this stage. There is a strong sense, and this is what maybe defines the stage, of feeling in between. I've not been able to answer the yes to the question, are you an adult, but feeling equally maybe repulsed by the idea that you're still an adolescent. So it's something in between. It's something, that's why Arnett at least felt like there was a new term. And finally, it's an age of possibilities. And that might be changing, actually. One of the dangers of writing a thesis on a very context-bound topic is that it could be obsolete in 2 years. This is an academic risk in general. But I wonder if we are now, if that sense of possibility of I can do whatever, that there are maybe some economic realities that make it a bit more challenging, and that might be even becoming more acute in as we move into the third decade of the 21st century. So this is sort of this five-theme shorthand description of what this means. I think I'll just highlight that term possibility again by saying that's the unique factor of in a sense, modern life, For most of human history, this has not been an option. For most of human history, the question, what am I going to do with my life, has not really been on the table in the same way that it is today. That can bring great possibility. I think we see that celebrated much in the media. That you can do anything, that you can be anything, and there's no limit to what you can do. I think we all know, kind of, that that's not totally true. And I think this can also be a very anxiety-inducing insight. Because maybe I don't want that much freedom. Maybe I don't want to have limitless possibilities. Maybe I'd like someone to tell me, why don't you pick from those three? Because it can be an incredible psychological burden to have to literally define myself and chart a course in a bewildering world with multiple confusing realities within it, not to mention economic anxiety. That's a pretty heavy burden. So I think, to go back to the insight from before, I should also check the time here. How are we doing for...
You go to 10:20.
Okay, sure. What time is it now?
9:55.
Okay, good. The insight from before about ghosts from the past, from the Matthew McConaughey, Cooper. I'll use an example from my own life, and I can use this because I've created with my father. So my parents, again, as I said before, came of age in a time when there was not a lot of freedom. In church life, there wasn't a lot of freedom. It was a kind of legalistic, pretty strict kind of church environment they grew up in. And even in terms of human development, it was a pretty train track type, this is what you do when you leave, and it's all sort of scripted for you. So they were quite determined to not do that with their kids. They experienced that as a negative thing. So I am resolved that I will not impose my will on my kids and tell them what they must do in life. And I can speak for myself and my brother and my sister who experienced that freedom as a mixed blessing. On the one hand, it was good because we had possibilities. On the other hand, we could have used a bit more guidance. Even just a word of encouragement. Think about this. But they had ghosts in their head. Don't do that. Let them decide. Give them freedom. So, and I say this not to disparage my parents, certainly, who I love dearly. But to me, it's one example of what it means to talk about. I think we all know this message of be whatever you want to be is ubiquitous. It's around. It's everywhere. It's in every children's movie, for example, that my kids watched when they were younger. Was this message of anything's possible, chase your dreams, the future's wide open. Which is a great message until it isn't.
Yeah, and I think in our North American context, it means something obviously very different from other
certainly
countries. I mean, I follow closely a chap in Uganda who's now 39, and his parents both died of HIV, and I met him playing squash in a bar. I was working on a volunteer project there, and I just kept up. Well, he's kept up with me pretty much because I financially support him all day, because he can't. I mean, the unemployment rate among young people in sub-Saharan Africa is 60%. 50%, 60%. He just can't find a job. He's gone to Rwanda to work last year to do some roofing, and he just can't find employment. And so his life is, in terms of its possibilities, is so much different than my kids and grandkids' experiences. It's just another planet, completely. And there's no infrastructure that supports him if he's out of work. And so it's just a completely different reality. So, I mean, we see the world from where we stand, right? I mean,
certainly.
That's just a reality.
And that's maybe where the insight that's come up twice already this morning, but part of what it means to grow up is that focus on the other. Mm-hmm. To not say that my job is to secure some sort of identity for myself and some sort of security for my future, but it's when we cross that border to say I actually have an obligation to that person too, that I have to care for people that are beyond my immediate circle. That's a challenging insight in a globalized world, certainly. Yeah, so this is certainly not to say this is a universal human. I think that's been where Arnett's been critiqued the most, academically speaking, has been while you're isolating one prosperous Western coming-of-age story and made that universal, and to which he received that critique, and says, but it's common, and it's here, it's where we live, so we must well talk about it. Because probably there is no universal. The humans are too diverse. There's no universal pathway from much as we would like the chart, it goes through 6 month increments all the way till we're dead. That'd be great. Or is that, it's a, it would be, it would omit somebody, certainly. Yeah. All right. A few key takeaways that I would like to sort of move toward, and then we can see where we're at time-wise, and then we can maybe refocus there. The first thing I would say is that the meaning of adulthood is certainly in flux, the meaning of that term, maybe even the usefulness of that term. It used to mean, or this is where we started today, roles or responsibilities that are defined by a certain tradition or a certain community of origin. That definition of adulthood that I define when I've arrived there by when I have accumulated a certain number of roles, or when I eat meat, let's say, that's no longer what it means. We're far closer to what you suggest, I think, which is that adulthood is something subjective. It's a sense. It's some kind of state of independence, or, well, Arnett would say his sort of shorthand definition based on lots of interaction with students is adulthood is learning standalone, which is sad in some ways, understanding of what it means to arrive as a human. That I know I've arrived when I'm alone, or when I don't need anybody else. Now, he means it in a sense of I'm no longer under my parents' roof, let's say, or I'm no longer needing them to send me a check every month to pay the rent, or whatever. But there's something I think that's uniquely modern about that notion of adulthood, too, that maybe we would want to push against a bit, especially as Christians, I would say.
Could you say it another way, that it's when you can no longer count on anybody else?
You can no longer count on anybody else.
Maybe you would like to be able to, but you can't. And then
okay, so the options are, yeah, okay. I see what you're saying. It took me a few seconds to get there.
Or maybe no longer codependent.
Right? Because there is something healthy about not needing, not being so dependent upon others. Or maybe the way we talked about dependence shifts. It's an interdependence that comes as opposed to what you're describing as a codependence. Useful clarification.
Many cultures, of course, don't foster that sort of idea, like an Indian culture, certainly. Well, there isn't anything close to a uniform Indian culture. But in India, there's just a lot more acceptance that you live interdependently as a family.
Yeah.
And they don't see it as being such a huge deal to be on your own. You always are relying on other people.
Yeah.
I mean, you see that in the novels of mystery and Nepal, and you know, the people just accept that I've got to rely on my family.
Certainly.
It doesn't make them any less than that.
No, it doesn't make less than that.
Which is a really useful insight, actually, because it might be that we have to return to some of those insights in the generation ahead.
Yeah. Sven and I have talked a lot about this because he used to be in the place of where you are. And he said when he was at CBI in those days, he said he used to talk a lot about freedom, choice, and responsibility. It strikes me that some of those words have to kind of come together. So there is freedom, and there is choice, and there is responsibility. And I said, you know, I like that. I think that's... It's kind of like we sometimes put too much weight on one word, and sometimes we have to take a bigger picture. And I somebody said freedom, and I think that but with freedom then comes something right away.
Yes, which is, I think, a very important insight, because I think we are, culturally speaking at least, very pumped about freedom. Or to use a different word, rights, if we want to transpose into ethical terminology. But responsibility language comes a bit more reluctantly, I think, to our lips. So freedom, choice, responsibility. Yeah, I like that. That's like a nice little terminological trinity for adulthood. Now this battery might die in a second. I got a notification that when it goes blank, then we'll have to find some other way. Maybe I'll slip this out just in case. But this is my 1988. Yeah, going just it takes 20 minutes to get going, so we'll start at this. Yes. Okay. So the other insight, the other takeaway is that I think there's a sense in which the desirability of adulthood is at least somewhat up in the air. And this is harder to define, but it certainly is prominent if you spend any amount of time online, which I would not recommend. It's less and less of an interesting place these days. But at least as adulthood has been modeled or offered, to young people, there's a sense in which I'm not actually sure I want that. Because that word actually means stasis, or it means I'm settling, or it means that I have a mortgage, if you can afford it. Or it means that I just sort of settle for this kind of monotonous drudgery of routine, which sort of doesn't look too interesting compared to a pretty free-floating, open-ended, exploratory understanding of the 20s. That means I gotta, like, maybe that's responsibility comes in, and it doesn't just look all that interesting, especially as we have a sense that youth is what we actually want in life. We don't aspire to maturity, we aspire to youth. So we have elaborate ways of trying to make ourselves look younger, act younger. We might be the first generation in history where the roles are inverted, where the young do not aspire to be like the old, but the old aspire to be like the young. Which is a major shift, actually. So you have these are just some silly kind of indicators, but this mentality that we shouldn't actually go, it's a trap. This is actually not, you're told to do this, but don't do it. Don't give in. It's actually a trap. What kinds of danger waiting on the horizon of that word? So don't settle for it. Don't settle for the monotony of adulthood. And you could have more. This one I love because it explains my life perfectly right now as I'm newly in a role that requires lots of emailing. This is a tweet that I love. Adulthood is emailing, sorry for the delayed response, back and forth to one of you guys. Yeah. That is very true, actually. This is, so that you get a quick kind of sense of, yeah, that sounds like drudgery, and it is. That probably is. But there's something about this that captures that sense of monotony. Even the phrase adulting, which became a verb sometime in the last few years that I wasn't really aware of, it's almost never used in a good way. I have to adult today, which is like, ugh. I didn't used to have to do this, but now I do. And it's not a good thing, it's drudgery, it's hard. It means I gotta get up in the morning and go to work or pay bills or something, and it's just, yeah. So there's an ambivalence toward the destination itself that I would say has crept in over the past couple of generations, not two for sure. That says, is that even what I want? Do I want that?
Yeah, that's what makes the world around. You know, it makes society function.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. So showing up when they're supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. If everybody said, I don't want to adult today, it would really create some problems. So, yes, okay. So there is a reconsideration, I would say, of adulthood. That is in the process of being renegotiated in 21st century context. Now, it is, we would have to say, a fluid category. It depends on how it's recognized. We've already talked about this. It's recognized differently in different cultures. What it means to be an adulthood in sub-Saharan Uganda is different than what it means to be an adult in West Vancouver. It'll look different in different places, we'll have different markers, we'll have different ways, but the key insight here is it's a sociological phenomenon. I don't always get to decide what those markers are. Other people might decide what they are, and they might recognize them and say, oh, you've arrived now. Who am I, in other words, can never be fully separated from who am I in the eyes of others. So as much as we like the idea that the self is a construction project that I control, I determine what are the facets of myself that will eventually make me who I will be. There is an inherently social aspect to adulthood that can never be fully escaped. And even if we can't articulate it, even if we only know when it's going wrong, it's still a social interaction that's taking place. So in our context, in 21st century context, youth is no longer a stage that is resolved in an adulthood. Youth is no longer even a stage, it's an ideal. It's a brand in some ways that is sought over the entire lifespan. And maybe one way to get at this is we maybe all have the experience at some point of coming across somebody who there's a bit of an incongruity between what they're trying to do with their appearance and how old they actually are. I mean, am I the only one who's see that? Then we kind of know, well, there's a youthful aspiration here, but it doesn't quite align with what's actually the case. It's an ideal that is being sought and marketed to aggressively. Lots of money could be made in trying to sell youth. That's a big shift, actually. The youth is not something we seek over the course of a lifespan. So, this is a famous, not famous, should be more famous than he is, an Australian sociologist named Harry Blatter, who also made his way onto the bibliography. He said, youth as a value is replacing adulthood as a goal. This trend is crucial to understanding contemporary uncertainties about adulthood, about what being grown up actually means, what promises it holds. So expectations of ourselves, of others, to grow up, to mature, to settle down, to walk the line and follow the beaten path of previous generations may help us set goals, but it may just as well give rise to no longer realizable expectations and then to self-doubt. As we wonder, am I actually even able to do this? So there's a huge shift embedded in what he's saying. He's maybe a little bit more positive about this than I would be. He's saying, you know, this whole metaphor, this whole idea of adulthood as walking the path that other people have set out for you, that's not really the case anymore. Now you decide what it looks like. You decide what you want to do. The expectations of others, don't really worry about that, because that'll just produce self-doubt when you don't realize it. But a huge shift, the game, between adulthood as something I decide and adulthood as something the other people decide. And I'm curious, as we hear that, where do our inclinations go? Is that something that I should be able to decide? Or is it something that other people should be able to decide? And what does it mean to ask that question inside of the church? Oh, I think we just lost the battery. Sorry. That's a good place to ask for a conversation then.
About mentorship here.
Yes, good.
Is mentorship something that the mentor intends to do, or is it an example, not even an example, a mentoring that young people, emerging adults, whatever, mm-hmm. want to look up to? Like, what is the role? I don't even know what I'm asking, but I think it's about this quote here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that we set out for something, but is it that the responsibility of the older folk, the older generation, live in such a way that the younger people want to be there, want to have a direction, want to have some kind of value?
That's a great question. I might just have other thoughts on that one. Especially from
I'd like to respond to that. I was reading a book by William Alcott. It's from the 1860s, I think. It's about instructions for young men. And there's a quote in there about young men should live as one day they'll be old, and old men should live in a way that, let me get the quote wrong, I'm paraphrasing anyway, but young men should live as though they're going to be old, and old men should understand that they were one day they were young. So there's something passed on, like, I want to understand how to live in the world and be in it and make changes in it and understand the way that I've been gifted spiritually and in characteristics and in personality. And I want to know that things like mistakes that I made that I think are a huge life-ending problem, an older man can come by and say, oh, you didn't pay rent this month, so here's what you do. It's not such a huge deal. The world isn't crashing down. And in mentorship, what I'm looking for is somebody to come by and say, all these little things right now that you see that are so unstable, they're so up in the air, they're so not figured out, you don't have to worry about all these things as much as you are. And that's a drag on my well-being. And for a mentor to come by and say, it'll be better someday. It doesn't sound like a platitude as much. It's somebody who's lived through that, who's a quote that, there's this TV show called West Wing. It's about the goings on in the White House, and my dad and I watching it. Actually, a lot of mentorship, like passing on of my father's wisdom to me, has been by the medium of this show. So there's an episode where there's an older man. He's the chief of staff. His name's Leo, and he's got a deputy chief of staff who's like half his age, and he encounters a problem at work. And then he says, "So this guy who falls into a hole one day, and he's down in this hole, and then a doctor comes by." And says, "Oh, I'll just write you this prescription." And he writes it down, throws it in the hole, walks by, and then a minister walks by and says, "Oh, I'll just write you this prayer," and throws it in the hole and walks on, and then a friend walks by and then jumps into the hole, and he says, "Well, what are you doing? Now we're both stuck down here." And he says, "Yeah, but I've been down here before, and I know the way out." So that's what I'm looking for in mentorship, is somebody who's walked through life and encountered problems and suffering and pain, but also has experienced joy and love and laughter and things like children and have developed in some way, and that's the wisdom I want imparted to me.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I think we also create mentorship to be such a formality.
Yeah.
And I just am thinking about this now. It's something that I wrote in response to some questions that might be asked later as well, is where was that ball dropped? So I'm not blaming either side. I think that it's interesting in an age that we're filled with so many choices. In a sense, the last choice I want to make is like, well, who do I want to mentor me, right? Like, we laugh, but that's the question that people are just like, well, I need the perfect mentor, right? Like, to know where I'm at. And then we just don't get one, which is, I think, hilarious and very sad. But then in the same respect, I would say the older generation, in a sense, has a rightful hesitancy, potentially, to also attach themselves, because we don't want to be imposing,
yeah.
Right? So then there's this tension of, well, I can't decide who I want to mentor me, and they're not sure if they should really ask if they could mentor me. So I think in that tension,
yeah.
It's difficult, because I agree with Andrew fully that I think when it's created to be such a formality, then it becomes, it becomes a job or a role, which is good. But I also think that if initiated and started, and this is where it's inefficient because it's a process, it's not a fix, which our culture loves fixes, it loves steps to adulthood, right? But I think it really does have to be something that's foundational in the church from a young age and not just beginning at adulthood. I think, or stopping at youth. And that's where I want to maybe talk a little bit later, because I think exactly what you're talking about, the youth to adulthood transition, that's where it's like somehow there's just an expectancy that, like, well, now we should start mentoring them, I guess, like, for adulthood, when really it's like that probably should have started when I was like 5 years old. Like, to some extent. So,
good question, yeah.
I think that's where I'd
say. I want to ask, thank you for that. I think you're naming some really important things, actually. And I think, going back to the question that started it, so do you sense there's like a timidity or a sense of, I don't want to use the word, I think, impose. Yeah. People don't want to impose or insert themselves into the lives of younger people.
Totally.
Is that, and why is the question? So that's unique.
Yeah. Well, if I can continue to answer.
Sure, yeah.
I think that's, first of all, the story of our age now, is with this freedom.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's the public sphere and there's the private sphere, which is a big thing that I've been thinking about reading about lately. The public sphere, we don't want to impose anything. That's only for the private in the house sphere, because that's really what we're being told. Religiously, that's what we're told. Like, religion is for the private. Objective truth, reality, reason is for the public, right?
Yeah.
So I think in that, the story of today with all the freedom is that, like, you decide, so therefore, who am I to tell you what to do?
Yeah.
Where mentorship, what we need is people being like, hey, think with your head here, right? Like, we need some clarity to some extent, like, not fully again, because I think it's a relationship, and that's where I would push mentorship as not being.
And there's a sense in which you have to develop some muscles.
Oh, for sure.
For discernment, but it's not open ended, right? And then there's, I think I get that.
Definitely.
Yeah,
I like just what you're saying resonates a lot with me. I've been in that stage for 8 years, 10 years, and to answer your question, I think something that would help is just people to come and walk with me where I'm at, some of the most helpful people have been to say, David, what you're in, that's normal. That's okay.
Yeah.
And just to sit in that with you. And then the other side of that is like, there is a timidity,
yeah.
a hesitancy, because we value that freedom. Like, yeah. You can do whatever you want. I don't want to tell you what to do. But sometimes, just how you mentioned a word of encouragement or
yeah.
blessing,
yeah.
that goes a long way.
I think you're naming something really important. I think the one thing I would add is, I think sometimes, I'll include myself in the generations above now, there's this sense that while these people are coming of age in a world I don't understand, it's a confusing world, and those problems are so complex. There's this default setting that says young people get it in a way that we don't, because they're surrounded by this in their schools, and they just have come of age in a world that's so complex that what do I have to offer? I'm not going to say it's an overstatement, but I'm just this dinosaur who doesn't really understand that complicated world. So that's also part of the timidity. Part of it is, as you say, David, that we don't want to impose. Mm-hmm. We've got like, the freedom. Part of it is this sense of, well, what do I have to offer? Like, I'm just... Mm-hmm. It's like a foreign country to me in some ways. So I think there's both.
Like, the world I grew yeah. up in is vastly different from the world my parents grew up in.
Totally, totally. And so that produces, I would say, in your parents, I'm not seeing your parents particularly, but in that generation, a nervousness about speaking. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably not... I would like to see older Christians especially be a little more bold. Not in a dogmatic kind of, you must do this kind of thing, but in a sense, I have something to say, and you can learn, and I'm going to offer that to you. You don't have to take it, but I'm going to offer. I mean, I think there is an immense encouragement that comes from seeing people who have walked the ways, as Andrew said, through some suffering, especially, because we live very insulated lives now, where suffering is a rumor. Not for everybody, certainly young people encounter things that are terrible, but anyways, it's 10:20, so we're going to...
I think my best mentor never offered any answers. Either that, or I don't remember what the answers were.
Well, what do you remember about them?
I remember they listened.
Yeah.
They took me seriously.
Yeah.
They encouraged. They would talk about possibilities, but never put a guilt trip on, like I had to follow any of them, or they would be disappointed in me.
Just talking about mentors, I mean, when I look back at the mentors that were instrumental in my going to maturity, hopefully, certainly the parents, I learned something about hard work from my mother, especially. I learned something about friendliness and optimism from my dad, who, for him, there was nothing like, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. He made mistakes, sure, but he was optimistic. Then you get into high school, and your high school teachers can have... I went to the Mennonite Educational Institute, mm-hmm. and Bill Weeb, I don't know if anybody recognizes his name, was one of the teachers. And I would consider him a mentor. And some of the other teachers who saw that I had some ability academically and encouraged me to continue this line. I remember, this is unreal because you people would find this very interesting. I found it very interesting that when I was in grade 11, and we had 40 kids in the class in EMEA. Some of the classes were kind of big. And one of the, I forget who it was, maybe it was Bill Weeks, says, how many of you are planning to go to university? Now, this is grade 11. Imagine what people would do today. And he says, how many of you are planning to go to university? Out of 40, two hands went up.
Wow.
Mine and somebody else. They weren't even thinking about it. Now, many of them subsequently did go to university, but that was the vision at the time. Now, you need a mentor to help you through that period and to encourage people to think higher than just being content with a high school education.
Well, the fact that you remember that, as that one person who said you should do this.
Oh, yeah.
That's the power of everything. So to name something... to name, to have the freedom to name something in people is a huge.
Yeah, if you get the encouragement by somebody that you respect, it means an awful lot to me.
You and then I'll break now. Okay, that's fine.
I think one thing too with mentorship that I think is important as well is also like with the walking, and I love the whole analogy, like I've been here before, I know the way out, which Andrew shared. I think it's also comforting for mentors to say, I don't know the way out. In a sense of, I think with this whole conversation, we're assuming that the people mentoring have reached adulthood and they're just perfectly content with everything that's in their life.
Yeah.
Which, and I, again, I'm speaking, so it's more a question to ask that I think that mentors need to ask, like, or mentees, or however you want to describe the younger person in the relationship, is actually there to be a conversation of, like, do you feel content with your life? Mm-hmm. Like, in a sense, because I think when it's like, well, I'm talking to someone who's reached adulthood,
right.
And now it's like, good, you got it, you know all the answers already, which I think is a great point that you said. It's actually, mentorship, I don't think it's necessarily giving answers as much as, this is what I know, and I'm still in this, maybe with different questions being asked. And I think that's important to answering this question.
Because there's an incredible, I'll stop after this. There's an incredible sense of, well, I don't know the right word, psychological comfort in seeing that somebody else, let's say, has open-ended questions at an older stage of life. Because then you have a mission, right? You don't feel like, what's wrong with me? There's an incredible blessing in that, I think, that older people can offer younger people. So it's a tricky balance, right? But it's desperately necessary, I think.
Yeah, let's just break for 5 minutes, go have a washroom break, and then let's reconvene for our panel.
I'm just going to announce that I've been recording Gil's talk, but if anyone who chimed in with questions wants it edited out, you can let me know afterwards. Thanks.